Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6,
E five, is equal to mc squared, in which energy is all equal
for man.
The human genome is our shared inheritance.
Cracks and cracks.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. When I was a teenager, there was a popular song by the Marvelettes called Too Many Fish in the Sea. The song, of course, was a metaphor for all the eligible young men available to a broken-hearted girl. But the metaphor worked because we all thought at the time that the number of fish in the sea was limitless. Well, after the collapse of the East Coast cod stocks and similar fisheries disasters around the globe, we know now that there is a limit to how much fish we can take before we drive a species to extinction. But according to our first guest today, that's really nothing new. He says we've been over-exploiting the seas for 1,000 years. But fish isn't the only thing on our menu today. We'll also sample some tasty dinosaur with a look at a new species that would be a dentist's dream. Plus, we'll check in on the weather on Titan, find out how to count the calories from a 500-year-old mummy, and learn why we have an appendix. But first, hook, line, and sinker. This is Quirks and Quarks. The state of the world's fisheries is, in the minds of many biologists, simply dismal. We're over-exploiting fish stocks. We're using destructive fishing practices. Industrial factory fishing fleets are vacuuming the ocean bottoms. And while some fisheries seem healthy, in many others we're harvesting marine life at a rate far beyond anything that could be considered sustainable. We tend to think of this as a modern problem, driven by the insatiable appetite of our growing population and the improvements in technology that have allowed fishers to hunt down and harvest every last fish they can find. But according to Dr. Callum Roberts, this isn't just a modern phenomenon. We've been devastating fisheries for at least 1,000 years. In his new book, The Unnatural History of the Sea, he traces the historical record of overexploitation of the oceans. And ironically, he thinks this could teach us a lot about how we might change our behavior in the future. Callum Roberts is a professor of marine conservation at the University of York in England. Dr. Roberts, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Pleasure to be here.
I was surprised in reading your book at just how far back in time you were able to reach to find examples of overfishing. How far back did you actually go?
Well, you can go back quite a long way using the written record, probably to about the 14th, 15th century, a little earlier in some places. But to go back beyond that, you often have to rely on the archaeological record. And the book opens really looking at the archaeological record in England. And archaeologists at the University of York, where I work, have been sifting through the refuse of medieval life and have been looking at what people were eating. And what they found was that there was a very rapid change in the composition of the diet around 1050 AD. And what that change entailed was a move from eating freshwater species, things like tench and pike and bream, salmon, to eating species that were exclusively from the sea, like herring and cod and other relatives of the cod. The sea fishing revolution, I believe, really came out of the world's first fisheries crisis. And that crisis was due to two factors. One was that there was a rising demand for fish. The population was growing rapidly. It was becoming increasingly urbanized. And Christian practices were spreading around Europe, which also involved prohibitions on eating the meat of quadrupeds on certain days of the year. And there were about 150 days that people could not eat the meat from quadrupeds. And so they turned to fish. At the same time, there was growing demand for power, and people started damming the rivers to create mill dams. What that did was it blocked off the runs of migratory fish from the sea, things like whitefish, salmon, and sturgeon. And those had been the mainstay of the diet. And so there was a decline in the amount of freshwater fish available, increase in demand. People started to go to sea to catch fish, and they've never turned back since then.
Well, your book is just a catalogue through history of fisheries disasters, one after another. Can you take me through just a couple of them? Just give me some examples.
Well, there are many cases where people overexploited fish. And in fact, people have been overexploiting fish from very early on. And we can date, for example, the origin of beam trawling, the dragging of weighted nets across the seabed, to the 14th century because of a complaint that was made to the king in 1376 in England. And what that entails is that the fishers are approaching the king and saying that there's this new and highly destructive device that certain fishers have contrived, and that they are destroying the marine habitats below water, and that they're also catching lots of undersized fish, and the commoners pray for a remedy. What happened, in fact, was the typical response of kings or rulers to such complaints, and that is that he established a committee to look into the complaint. And the committee decided that it would be fine if this device was simply used offshore rather than in the estuaries where a lot of the fishing was taking place at the time. But clear evidence of destructive fishing taking place early on. We can see through time the same kind of examples where the fishers were outraged by each improvement in technology, the introduction of long lines, the introduction of steam trawling in the 1880s, for example, was another case where people were outraged at the destructive tendencies and the overfishing that this increase in fishing power managed to achieve. And so that led to a series of inquiries in England, investigating complaints made against trawling, and in particular focusing on the damage that trawls did to the seabed habitat, and also the overfishing that it caused. Many people using nets or hook and line found that their catches fell dramatically as soon as trawling was introduced to a region. And people resisted it for a long time, especially in America, North America and Canada. But eventually trawling was introduced everywhere because it was such an efficient way of catching fish.
Well, why were the efforts of those who were trying to conserve the sea, why did they go unheeded?
Well, I think at the time there was always a solution to the problem of overfishing. Overfishing was generally localized, so people had the option to fish somewhere else where fish stocks were in better condition, or they could turn to other species that had not yet been exploited to the same degree. And so throughout the history of fishing, really, those two remedies have been adopted. In my view, we are reaching the end of that route now, because people fish almost everywhere in the oceans to depths of 2,000, 3,000 meters in some cases. And we also exploit the majority of the species that are commercially valuable and viable. And we don't have many options that we can turn to once those species have collapsed.
One of the things that you do describe so well in the book is the almost unimaginable productivity of the sea, just how many fish were there at the time. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, if I could just let some of the people who saw these things tell you about it. For example, John Mason, who was governor of one of the first colonies in Newfoundland at Cupid's Cove, he wrote in 1620, "But of all the land and wildlife, the most admirable is the sea, so diversified with several sorts of fishes abounding therein. Cods are so thick by the shore that we hardly have been able to row a boat through them. I've killed of them with a pike." And he goes on to say that three men in a boat could catch 1,000 cod per day using just hand lines. And that comes up to, in a 16-hour day of fishing, something like one cod every 3 minutes continuously throughout that period. Further south in Virginia, in the colonies there, people were astounded by the abundance of river herring. And William Byrd wrote of the alewife, or the river herring, in 1728. "When they spawn, all streams and waters are completely filled with them. And one might believe, when he sees such terrible amounts of them, that there was as great a supply of herring as there is water."
I think you had another quote where somebody said you could put an axe in the water and it would stay upright.
That's right. Yes, that was a quote made in the 16th century about the herring in Scandinavia.
Unbelievable. Now, I think fisheries biologists thought that this was an exaggeration. Do we now know if it was really like that, looking back?
Well, I think the consistency of the stories of the abundance of fish and marine mammals that people brought back from their travels around the world is such that we really should believe what they had to say. And certainly the kind of catch rates that people were getting were recorded in great detail. And those catch rates give us an indication that there must have been the fish there for them to take. So I think we have been too ready to dismiss some of the tales of abundance from the past. And in reality, I think they have a great deal to tell us about what the condition of the oceans really was like 200, 300, 400 years ago.
Well, one of the problems, and again, you point this out in your book, that modern biologists have, is that they have never seen a fishery that's unexploited. The modern science wasn't around at that time. But how can these historical reconstructions help us figure out what the seas really should look like?
Well, I think one of the things that historical reconstructions can do is to set what we have in the oceans today in the context of what there once was in the absence of exploitation. And for example, on the Scotian Shelf off Nova Scotia, it's been estimated based on very detailed analysis of catch records from the middle of the 19th century that the cod populations there have declined to just 0.3 of 1% of what was there in the middle 19th century. So there's 300 times less cod there today than there was in the past. That tells us something about how much we really need to rebuild populations, because one of the underpinnings of the science of fisheries management is that we need to maintain populations at a productive level, at the most productive level for supplying fish protein. And typically that productive level is considered to be about half the size of the unexploited population. But if you don't know what the size of the unexploited population is, you're really in trouble. And it turns out that we've been grossly underestimating the size of unexploited populations based on just recent data from the last few decades, when what we should really be doing is looking back much deeper in time and seeing what was there before fishing intensities really rose to the levels that they started to impact on the size of stocks.
How has the development of new fishing technologies contributed to this problem?
Well, new fishing technologies have always bailed people out from the product of their own overfishing. What tends to happen in the fishery cycle is that opportunity or necessity provoke the beginning of a fishery. People go out and start catching animals. As they do that, the fish stock declines. And as the stock starts to decline, they improve the fishing technology that they're applying until the fish stock declines further. And as the stock declines and declines, then more and more powerful fishing technologies and greater improvements have to be thrown at the industry simply to maintain catch rates.
But again, this isn't just the story of the 20th century. This goes back in time as well.
It certainly does. And I talked about the introduction of the beam trawl in the 14th century, but that was followed in about the 17th or 18th century by the introduction of long lines, where instead of just having a hand line that you dangled over the side of the boat with a few hooks on it, you started having hundreds or thousands of hooks on lines that were set for a period of a day or two before they were then gathered in. The addition of steam power to trawlers in the late 19th century vastly expanded the reach of fishing and the depth to which people could exploit the sea. And also it increased the ability to fish into areas of rugged seabed, which were formerly inaccessible because the trawlers simply didn't have the power to drag their nets through these areas when it was just the power was just supplied by the wind. And then in the 1970s onwards, we've started to see the application of high technology electronics, and in the 1990s, satellite positioning systems, which allow you to drop your net into very precisely into particular canyons in the sea, which were formerly unfished because they were too dangerous to get to. But now they can be reached and with relative safety for the fishing captains.
So have things really changed in the 20th century, or is it just more of the same?
Well, what has changed is the size of the fish stocks that are out there to exploit. It's estimated that from 1900 to 2000, the amount of large fish in the sea, like cod and halibut and hake and ling, in aggregate has declined by something like 90%. For some species, it's much worse than that. For example, northern cod has declined by at least 98%, and halibut in the North Atlantic has virtually disappeared. Common skate has disappeared from the waters around England, and that was formerly a really important element of the fish catches in the late 19th century. So things have changed, but we are still managing to maintain catches from the sea simply by applying ever more sophisticated ways of catching the resources.
Well, your book is a long list of fisheries catastrophes, and history seems to be working against us, but you do mention that there is a way out of this, and you've been on our program talking about this before, and it's the concept of the marine preserve. How can that actually help us stop this vicious cycle of over-exploitation?
Well, marine reserves are an idea which really has been resurrected in modern times. In the past, we were unable to fish everywhere, so there were always places that were off limits to fishing, de facto reserves. They were too dangerous to fish, they were too deep, too remote, too rough, and so people avoided them. What we realize today is that fish populations in those areas that are off limits to fishing are very important in sustaining catches from areas that are exploited. And the reason that they do that is that they support big populations of breeding adult fish and shellfish, and their offspring get transported by ocean currents into surrounding fishing grounds where they can replenish them. And they reserves also spill over juvenile and adult fish into surrounding fishing grounds as the density of animals in the protected areas increases. So they really act as sources for the fishing industry. They're money in the bank for the fishing industry. The best available science suggests that we can maximize the benefit to fisheries by setting aside something like 20 to 40% of the oceans. That science also says that we will be able to achieve our nature conservation goals by setting aside a similar amount of the oceans. And we can achieve all of these goals together by designing networks of marine reserves that protect commercially important species at places where they're most vulnerable, things like spawning aggregation sites, nursery areas, and so forth. And also by targeting places that are very important for nature conservation. So we have the full variety of life in the sea protected somewhere.
Well, I guess it's been an unnatural history of the sea, but we can hope for a natural future. Dr. Roberts, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Callum Roberts is a professor of marine conservation at the University of York in England. His new book, The Unnatural History of the Sea, is published by Island Press.